The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth. We are socially distanced in the Spectator boardroom. James, when it comes to the big news today, one of the things that's been dominating the conversation is something we don't really know what the certainty of it is, which is the news that the business secretary, Alok Sharma, has gone into self-isolation and had a coronavirus test. Now, he is by no means the first cabinet minister to believe they might have coronavirus, but I think the reason that this has triggered quite a lot of interest in particular is it comes after MPs were told to return to Parliament physically, and he gave a statement in the House, and there are questions when you look at that 2 metre conga line. So, dealing with hypotheticals, is this potentially going to prove embarrassing to the government if, after all this effort, we get to a situation where ministers are having to self-isolate?
The aim of Parliament coming back was to try and send a message to the country that it's that you can go back to work, it's going to be okay. And so far, it's actually turning out to demonstrate the difficulties of coming back to work. So there's been a whole issue of, you know, how do you make your workplace, in this case Parliament, COVID secure, in inverted commas. You know, how do you accommodate those people who need to continue to shield, who can't physically come back into the office? And now Alok Sharma looks like he might become a kind of initial test of the whole track and trace strategy, you know, having to get in touch with contact tracers to say that, you know, yesterday he had a 45-minute meeting with the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. Now, someone in the government, someone was saying to me, look, actually, because social distancing was maintained, you can make the argument this actually should reassure people about track and trace, which is if your workplace is operating social distancing, even if one of your colleagues gets coronavirus, you shouldn't end up having to go into isolation. I think that's a rather optimistic reading of the situation. I think this risks the danger of highlighting that rather absurd voting line you were talking about earlier, and people will say, well, why on earth didn't you just carry on letting MPs vote remotely? You could have revived the Commons chamber, allowed MPs who were in the chamber to intervene on speakers and things like that, but kept the remote voting.
Yes, and we also have a situation where, depending on the result of that test, we've learnt today that, for example, Alok Sharma was in a meeting with the Prime Minister, 45 minutes at least, at a distance of 2 metres. But again, there's an interesting thing here, which is, even though you may not be supposed to isolate if you've kept this distance, if we then find out, for example, that certain players in this game who have encountered Alok Sharma are ill despite allegedly keeping that 2 metre distance, it raises more questions. So in a way, what we could be heading to is a stress test of the government's test and trace.
Yes, and also the other issue with test and trace is you're meant to isolate even if you've had, because no one's certain yet whether it gives you immunity. So Boris Johnson ended up in intensive care with coronavirus, which most medical evidence would suggest would give you immunity. But under the track and trace rules, if it turned out that him and Alok Sharma were sitting 1.5 metres apart rather than 2 metres apart, he should then go into self-isolation. You know, this is the danger of it. And I think certainly if he does test positive, and let's hope that he doesn't, because no one should wish anyone to be ill, if he does, I think you will see lots of people kind of analysing stills from the footage of Parliament voting on Tuesday and kind of trying to measure out the distance he was standing between people either side of him and all that kind of thing.
Now, in other news, when it comes to the government's plans to try and suggest to people that now is the time to go back to work and they can do so safely, Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, said today that face masks will be mandatory from the 15th of June. It's no longer just a suggestion, something they think you should do. You could be declined or told you cannot go on public transport if you don't have a face mask. James, it wasn't so long ago we were having press conferences where ministers were telling us face masks don't particularly make that much of a difference. So what's changed here?
I think this is about trying to give people confidence to go back outside. I don't think anyone's produced any evidence that suggests that face masks can do harm. And so obviously, why not to some extent? But I also think the hope is the public remain very nervous about heading back out to work. And I think the hope, or heading to shops, I think the hope is that it will make people feel more confident. Everyone around here is wearing a face mask, it's going to be all right. I'm also struck by it because having come in at various points, I think the number of people wearing face masks on London transport certainly has dropped in the last fortnight or so. On the bus this morning, I think that, you know, there weren't very many people on the bus at all, but kind of less than a quarter of them were wearing a face mask, when probably a few weeks ago it would have been more than half.
Now, in terms of world news, in this week's issue of The Spectator, we have our editor Fraser Nelson writing about why the British government should be committing to making it easy and offering citizenship for those in Hong Kong amid the security law China's trying to bring about. And James, something you've written about extensively. We both spoke to Neil O'Brien a few weeks ago about the scepticism about Chinese relations that's built in the Conservative Party, but also I think you can see it in various Labour politicians as well. But for all the Sino-scepticism there currently is, it's not yet clear that business is taking the same sceptical approach to China that the government appears to be leaning towards. And today we heard from HSBC, didn't we?
Yeah, HSBC have essentially come out in support of this national security law that the Chinese government is trying to impose on Hong Kong. But the statement is, to put it mildly, convoluted, saying that this is in accordance with one country, two systems, which seems a rather intellectually surprising proposition. But, you know, if you look at where HSBC makes its money, it actually loses money in Europe, I think, last year, I'm right in saying. It's obvious why it has said it. Now, I think it'll be an interesting test of public sentiment. If you think back to the 80s, Katie, people boycotted Barclays Bank because of its links with apartheid South Africa. It'll be interesting to see whether HSBC loses accounts over this issue, whether people decide to bank with another bank because HSBC have decided to go along with this law. And so I think that will be an interesting test of kind of consumer opinion on this issue. And I think it also tells you something else, which is China is now a large enough and developed enough market that there will definitely be firms that prioritise their ability to sell in that market over pretty much anything else.
And when it comes to the offer the UK government plans to make to the people of Hong Kong, James, at the moment, how generous is what they're offering? Because clearly we've heard lots of warm words from Dominic Raab, from other members of the government. But when it comes to the exact specifics...
So what they're essentially offering people is an insurance policy. They are saying you can come to the UK for 12 months, that begins, and you can work, and that begins to put you on a path to citizenship. But what they're not doing is trying to actively incentivize people to come here. So there's no offers of financial support for people who want to come here or anything like that. And I think there is a kind of interesting question as well, which is, I think that the most immediate effect of this policy will not be the number of people who come here. It will be the fact that the close to 3 million people in Hong Kong who are entitled to a British national overseas passport but don't currently have one, I think you'll see a big uptick in the number of people applying for one. And I think what you'll see lots of people in Hong Kong do, rather than coming here, they will get their British national overseas passport. They will move, you know, some of their assets out of the jurisdiction to somewhere in the West, beyond the reach of the Chinese government. And, you know, they will pack the proverbial suitcase and have it under the bed. And their view will be, if things get worse, I'm getting out of here. So I expect we will see a bigger spike in the number of people applying for a British national overseas passport than in people moving here from Hong Kong.
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening. Do join us again tomorrow.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online, for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.